This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. As we go to air this hour, Chief U.S. Weapons Inspector Charles Dulfer is testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on his investigation into Iraq's possible weapons of mass destruction. Many analysts say this testimony and the 1,500-page report that goes with it are as close to a final word on Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons programs as we can expect. Dulfer took over the Iraq Survey Group last December after its former head, David Kaye, resigned. Mr. Dulfer began his testimony a few minutes ago, and in a few minutes we'll hear from NPR correspondent Mike Schuster and former weapons inspector David Kaye. But right now we go live to the Armed Services Committee and Mr. Dulfer's testimony.
Overall, the hope is that not only will we see what Saddam decided to do with WMD, but why. This may be instructive for future policy considerations and certainly for future intelligence considerations. The second chapter of the report is an extensive analysis of Iraq's financing and procurement, a bid to identify the resources available to Baghdad and examine how they were allocated. We made it a high priority to obtain complete information from the oil ministry and the state oil marketing organization. These data were extremely valuable in obtaining an understanding of how the regime operated and its priorities. This is a way of bounding the problem in a sense. Because Iraq had limited resources, that was one of the ways we could delimit our analysis. It was turned out to be quite instructive. Our investigation makes clear that the top priority for Saddam was to escape the economic stranglehold of UN sanctions. Sanctions limited his ambitions in many ways and took an enormous toll on Iraqi society. The disintegration of the middle class, civil infrastructure, the health system, and the blight on the hope of young Iraqis were clear through the 90s. The UN Security Council, in attempting to mitigate the effects of sanctions on innocent Iraqis, created the Oil for Food program. It is instructive that the regime rejected the opportunity to export oil for civil goods until conditions were so bad that they threatened the survival of the regime. Chapter 2, this chapter, makes clear the range of steps the regime took to erode support for and the efficacy of the UN sanctions program. The steps the regime took to erode sanctions are obvious in the analysis of how revenues, particularly those derived from the Oil for Food program, were used. Over time, sanctions had steadily weakened to the point where Iraq, in roughly the 2000 to 2001 timeframe, was confidently designing missiles around components that could only be obtained outside of sanctions. Moreover, illicit revenues grew to quite substantial levels during the same period, and it is instructive to see how and where the regime allocated these funds. Our investigation also makes quite clear how Baghdad exploited the mechanism for executing the Oil for Food program to give individuals and countries an economic stake in ending sanctions. The regime followed a pattern that Saddam has applied throughout his career, offering rewards and a rationale for accepting them, successfully arguing its case that the sanctions were harming the innocent and that the moral choice was to elude and diminish them. It is grossly obvious how successful the regime was. It is also grossly obvious how the sanctions perverted not just the national system of finance and economics, but to some extent international markets and organizations. The procurement and finance section notes that a sizable portion of the illicit revenues generated under the Oil for Food program went to the Military Industrial Commission, that is, the government-run military industrial establishment. The funding for this organization, which had responsibility for many of the past WMD programs, went from approximately $7.8 million in 1998 to $350 million in 2001. During this period of growing resource availability, many military programs were carried out, including many involving the willing export to Iraq of military items prohibited by the Security Council. And I would note that some members of the Security Council participated in violating those very same resolutions. The remaining four chapters deal with the different types of WMD programs which Iraq had previously worked. The first of these, the delivery system chapter, describes the work Iraq had been pursuing with respect to missiles and unmanned aerial vehicles. Iraq continued to work on missile delivery systems in the wake of the Gulf War. Some missile activity was permitted, in fact, by the UN resolutions. Saddam drew a distinction, however, between long-range missiles and other WMD, a distinction not drawn in the UN resolutions. Iraq's missile development infrastructure continued to develop under sanctions and included work on propulsion, fuels, and even guidance systems. As more funding became available following the implementation of the OFF program, the Oil for Food program, Saddam directed more missile activities. In the latter years, more foreign assistance was brought in, including both technology and technical expertise. While it is clear that Saddam wanted a long-range missile, there was little work done on warheads. It is apparent that he drew the line at that point, so long as sanctions remained. However, while the development of ballistic missile delivery systems is time-consuming, if and when Saddam decided to place a non-conventional warhead on the missile, this could be done quite quickly. The chemical weapons and biological weapons warheads put on Iraqi missiles in 1990 and 1991, for example, were built in months. A couple of points are of interest from the Iraqi missile efforts. One is that they did not abide by the range limits set in UN Security Council Resolution 687. The range capabilities of the ballistic missiles they were developing exceeded the stated limits. Iraq also used components from SA-2, those are surface-to-air missile engines, that they had been expressly prohibited from doing. Iraq also produced fuel that was not declared. They also tested UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, in excess of the range limits. Iraq missile developers became so confident that others would violate the sanctions that they designed new missile systems which depended upon the import of guidance systems which were prohibited by sanctions. Further, they drew upon foreign expertise that was readily available for such areas as propulsion, again, in violation of the sanctions. The next chapter is on nuclear programs, and it reviews the program up to the 1991 war and describes the activities of the scientists and engineers following the war. The analysis shows that despite Saddam's expressed desire to retain knowledge of his nuclear team and his attempts to retain some key parts of the program, during the course of the following 12 years, Iraq's ability to produce a weapon decayed steadily. Sanctions and inspections lasted longer than Saddam anticipated. The inspections were also much more intrusive than expected. Therefore, retention of weapons material put at risk his higher immediate objective of escaping sanctions. Nevertheless, Saddam's son-in-law and chief weapons development manager, Hussein Kamel, directed that design information and very limited physical material be hidden from inspectors. These concealment efforts were successful until Hussein Kamel himself, the son-in-law, fled to Jordan in 1995. There were also efforts to retain the intellectual capital of nuclear scientists by forbidding their departure from Iraq and keeping them employed in government areas. However, over time, there was decay in the team. Unlike other WMD areas, nuclear weapons development requires thousands of knowledgeable scientists as well as a large physical plant. Even with the intention of keeping these talented people employed, a natural decay took place, and the time it would take for Iraq to build a nuclear weapon tended to increase for the duration of the sanctions. The Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission utilized the same people in a range of projects during the 1990s and addressed technical problems akin to those in nuclear weapons development. These efforts, however, cannot be explicitly tied to an intention to revive a nuclear weapons program. Despite this decay, Saddam did not abandon his nuclear ambitions. He made clear his view that nuclear weapons were the right of any country that could build them. He was very attentive to the growing Iranian threat, especially its potential nuclear component, and he stated that he would do whatever it took to offset the Iranian threat, clearly implying matching Tehran's nuclear capabilities. Saddam observed that India and Pakistan had slipped across the nuclear weapons boundary quite successfully. Those around Saddam seemed quite convinced that once sanctions were ended and all other things being equal, Saddam would renew his efforts in this field. The chapters dealing with chemical weapons and biological weapons tell somewhat different stories. In the chemical weapons area, the Iraqis had long experience with production and use of mustard and nerve agents. In Baghdad's view, these weapons saved Iraq from defeat in the war with Iran and, in combination with biological weapon capabilities, deterred the United States from deposing the regime in 1991. Following the Iran-Iraq war, Iraqi chemical weapons activity shifted from production to research and development of more potent and stabilized agents. In contrast to the nuclear field, chemical weapons work requires not thousands of scientists, but hundreds. The top expertise was developed among a few dozen scientists and chemical production engineers. Once inspections began in 1991, Iraq chose to yield most of its weapons and bulk agent as well as the large facilities that were widely known to exist. As in the other WMD areas, Saddam sought to sustain the requisite knowledge base to restart the program eventually, and to the extent it did not threaten the Iraqi efforts to get out from sanctions, he chose to sustain the inherent capability to produce such weapons as circumstances permitted in the future. Over time, and with the infusion of funding and resources following acceptance of the Oil for Food program, Iraq effectively shortened the time that would be required to reestablish a chemical weapons production capacity. Some of this was a natural collateral benefit of developing an indigenous chemical production infrastructure. By 2003, Iraq would have been able to produce mustard agent in a period of months and nerve agent in less than a year or two. We have not come across explicit guidance from Saddam on this point, yet it was an inherent consequence of his decision to develop a domestic chemical production capacity. Iraq denied it had offensive biological weapons programs to inspectors in 1991 and secretly destroyed existing stocks of weapons and agent in 1991 to 1992. Iraq decided to retain the main biological weapons production facility, but under a guise of using it to produce single-cell protein for animal feed. These decisions were taken with Saddam's explicit approval. Saddam clearly understood the nature of biological weapons. He personally authorized their dispersal for use in 1991 against coalition forces, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. He clearly took steps to preserve this capability and was successful until 1995. Preservation of Iraq's biological weapons capabilities was simpler than any other WMD area because of the nature of the material. First, the number of experts required is quite small, perhaps a couple dozen. Then, two, the infrastructure to produce agent can be readily assembled from quite simple domestic civilian plants. Moreover, little, if any, activity would be necessary to keep this option on the shelf. Some activity that might have been related to a biological program has been examined closely, including work with a biopesticide, Bacillus thuringiensis. While this work could have been related to advancing Iraqi anthrax knowledge, information is inconclusive. This work could and certainly did sustain the talent needed to restart a potential biological weapons program. However, we can form no absolute conclusion whether this work represented active efforts to develop further anthrax programs. Given the developing infrastructure in Iraq in the late 1990s and early 2000s, such a reconstitution could be accomplished quite quickly. Other aspects of the Iraqi BW program remain cloudy. For example, it is still difficult to rule on whether Iraq had a mobile biological weapons production effort or made any attempts to work with smallpox as a weapon. We were able to eliminate some of the questions and resolve some of the questions which circulated about the mobile question earlier, though, however, and I can deal with those in question. What is clear is that Saddam retained his notions of the use of force, had experience that demonstrated the utility of WMD. He was making progress in eroding sanctions, a lot of progress, and had it not been for the events of 9/11/2001, things would have taken a very different course for the regime. Most senior members of the regime and scientists assumed that the programs would begin in earnest when sanctions ended, and sanctions were eroding. A variety of questions about Iraqi WMD capabilities and intentions remain unanswered, even after the extensive investigation by ISG. For example, we cannot yet definitively say whether or not WMD materials were transferred out of Iraq before the war. Neither can we definitively answer some questions about possible retained stocks, though, as I say, it is my judgment that retained stocks do not exist. Developments in the Iraqi intelligence services appear to have been limited in scope, and I'm referring here to some laboratories which were discovered in late 2003, where the Iraqi intelligence service was...
We've been listening to the testimony of U.S. Chief Weapons Inspector Charles Dulfer before the Senate Armed Services Committee. When we return from a break, a former U.S. Chief Weapons Inspector joins us, and NPR's Mike Schuster. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We've just been listening to some testimony by Chief U.S. Weapons Inspector Charles Dulfer before the U.S. Armed Services Committee. And now we're joined in Studio 3A by former Chief Weapons Inspector David Kay and in our Los Angeles studios by NPR correspondent Mike Schuster. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So, Mike, I'd like to start with you. You've been listening to the testimony, and maybe for those who've joined us late or actually we missed the very beginning of it, Mike, could you give us an overview of what Mr. Dulfer has been saying?
Well, what his report essentially confirms is the view that has existed for quite some time, which is that when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction or stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. In particular, it did not have nuclear weapons. I think Mr. Dulfer goes a little bit further and has asserted today that, in fact, after 1991, there was no evidence of nuclear weapons in Iraq. And in fact, on the eve of the invasion, Iraq was even further from getting nuclear weapons than it was in 1991 at the end of the Gulf War. However, Mr. Dulfer's report also focuses intensely on the intentions of Saddam Hussein, and he says those intentions were always there to restart their weapons of mass destruction program once economic sanctions and the other constrictions on Iraq were lifted, and that those sanctions were eroding in the years of the Bush administration before the invasion of Iraq. Very interesting point. Apparently, some of the new information in Dulfer's report comes from Saddam Hussein himself. An official of the U.S. government told reporters yesterday that Saddam Hussein has discussed this issue particularly of nuclear weapons, Iraq's and his intentions, with an FBI agent who has been interrogating him while he's been incarcerated. Dulfer said today that Saddam Hussein was attentive to the growing Iranian threat of a nuclear weapon, and that he stated he would do anything to match Iran's threat. Now, what we know about Iran's nuclear weapons program is that it's 18 years old and it was developed largely in secret. And throughout the 1990s and into the new century, Iran was continuing to develop underground and in secret a nuclear weapons program. This suggests that Saddam Hussein was aware of it, and his interest in nuclear weapons, should the sanctions be removed, was focused on what he believed was a threat from Iran.
Well, David Kaye, you took over from Charles Dulfer about 10 months ago, and if I've got the timing right, that was just about the time Saddam Hussein was captured. So presumably there was no information from him that you had at the time, but is that the new part that we've learned today from Mr. Dulfer's testimony that takes us forward from what you knew 10 months ago?
That's right. Charles took over from me in January of this year, so and it was essentially at the time that Saddam came into U.S. captivity. We had quite a bit of evidence at that time in October and in January when I testified that senior Iraqi officials who were already in detention testified to Saddam's continuing intention and desire at some point to resume his WMD program. I think we have more evidence of that today. It's not really new.
But has the bottom line, is there any evidence from what you've heard so far that there's any change at all on the bottom line of where you were 10 months ago?
No, just the opposite. In fact, my surprise is that there are no surprises. There were no WMD stockpiles, my conclusion, Charles Dulfer's conclusion. Weapons disappeared in 91. The real weapons activity disappeared around 1995. So we're left with some vague intention at some point to resume.
It's a hard thing. I mean, proving a negative, everybody knows that just because you didn't find it, you can always say you didn't look hard enough. But you did say, we played a clip of tape from you speaking to reporters a year ago at the top of the show where we said, at some point, any reasonable person is going to say the search is finished. Are you satisfied we're at that point?
I'm satisfied. Look, as a researcher, you'd always like more data. That's just part of your genetic makeup. But Charles Dulfer and I followed exactly the same strategy. Since you cannot prove a negative, you can't dig up all of Iraq, you start by looking to see if any weapons were produced. And you look at the productive capacity, how the money went, how scientists and engineers were employed. If there were no weapons produced, there was nothing to hide. And essentially, we've come to the exact same conclusion. I find that comforting in terms of my comfort in the hypothesis that no weapons existed.
Mike Schuster, you were listening to the testimony. Did it sound to you like to some degree, Mr. Dulfer was trying to bury the lead, essentially, that the big message from this report is that he's found nothing more, but that intentions are, of course, something that the president has been speaking about quite a lot lately?
I'm not sure you can say that, Joe. Delfer has written a report. It's a large report, and it probably will be seen now as the most extensive examination of a couple of decades of Iraq's efforts to gain nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. And Delfer benefits from having been the deputy head of the UN Special Commission on Iraq, which carried out all the weapons inspection of the 1990s. This is the kind of report, I think, that UNSCOM was hoping to do.
UNSCOM,
the UN Special Commission on Iraq, was hoping to do, but never got a chance to do. And so what Delfer was reporting to the Senate Armed Services Committee, going through chapter by chapter, and I'm not sure we can ascribe motivation to him that he was looking to bury the lead. I think what he was trying to do was being as thorough and careful as possible in front of the Senate committee. But of course, when he comes around to his conclusions about nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, the conclusions jump out and make news.
Okay, let's take some of your calls. You've been all patient in listening to this. Remember that you can call us here and ask your questions of either David Kaye, former chief weapons inspector, or Mike Schuster, my colleague, NPR correspondent, who's at NPR West. And our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Drew in Wichita, Kansas. Drew, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you all for allowing me to come to your show. By the way, Mr. Kaye just made a very, very big point that I think is something that maybe sometimes gets glossed over. It's not necessarily looking for the actual items. It's looking for the mess that's made in making those items. Those things are hard to hide, and I think sometimes we don't realize that and sometimes are a little too literal. I have a general question for all of you because it's something that I struggle with. We all know and have said that we know that at some point there were weapons of mass destruction available because Saddam used them, and that's in the past. We know that happened. We know that it's likely he had some continuing stockpiles of those. They don't take a lot of room, so that's a possibility. But then we do know that certain things have happened since then. We had the improvised explosive device using the canister exploding the sarin gas and the additional, I believe, half dozen to a dozen other shells that were recovered unexploded since we went there. Open source suggests that Syria bought a lot of things right before our invasion that might have been nuclear materials. We don't know that one for certain, but how do we, as the public, reconcile the things that we see, like the sarin gas things, that there was enough there to kill 1.5 million people, against reports like what we're hearing today? How do we get the broad gulf there gapped?
Drew, thanks for that question. David Kaye.
Well, first on the sarin that showed up in Iraq after Operation Iraqi Freedom, half dozen shells. These are all shells that relate to the pre-1991 production. It's easy to type. It's a forensic activity. We know the age of it. The Iraqi sarin was extraordinarily unstable under normal environmental conditions, which are demanding in Iraq, to say the least. So that the shell, the only thing that would have hurt you about that shell was the explosive charge around it. And in fact, the best evidence is the insurgents didn't understand it was a sarin shell to begin with. Now, there's just no evidence that Iraq produced any large amounts of chemical nerve agent after 1991. In fact, all the evidence is just the opposite. And the Delfer report reports exactly the conclusion I came to in January. There is no evidence of any transfer of weapons material to Syria, and certainly not of weapons, in the lead-up to the Gulf War. Although that's an area that will always have some ambiguity because the Syrians, to say the least, have not been cooperative in running down any leads in Syria. But the bulk of the evidence really points that things did go to Syria, but they weren't weapons of mass destruction or weapons material.
Mike Schuster, I wonder, do you think that there is any confusion? Is there? It seems to me that the message has been pretty clear, even though there have been these exceptions, such as the canister of sarin that was discovered, as the caller mentioned.
Yeah, I think that the message is quite clear over the course of the last year in David Kaye's initial remarks and his interim report, and now this report from Charles Delfer. Kaye and Delfer are both very well-versed experts in this field, and they used the resources of the U.S. military for more than a year to go all over Iraq to try to come up with their conclusions. And neither of them, in my view, were wed to the anti-war view or a bias that they didn't want to find these weapons of mass destruction. I think both set out to assuming that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they became convinced that their initial assessments were wrong. I know Charles Delfer did, because Delfer, as deputy head of the UN Special Committee, the UN Weapons Inspectors, always emphasized to me when I interviewed him in the 1990s that there were enormous number of unanswered questions about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. So I think that these conclusions, these reports, I think at this stage should be seen as the most reliable and definitive account of what existed in Iraq.
We're going to be checking back in with the hearing throughout this hour. One issue touched upon by Charles Delfer as he finished his opening statements was the connection between the current insurgency in Iraq and possible leftover stockpiles of chemical weapons, referred to in the following clip as CW.
A risk that has emerged since my previous report to Congress is the connection of former regime CW expertise with anti-coalition forces. ISG has uncovered evidence of such links and undertook a sizable effort to track down and prevent any lash-up between foreign terrorists or anti-coalition forces and either existing CW stocks or expertise from the former regime that could be used to produce such weapons. I believe we got ahead of this problem through a series of raids throughout the spring and summer. I am convinced that we successfully contained a problem before it matured into a major threat. Nevertheless, it points to the problem that the dangerous expertise developed by the previous regime could be transferred to other hands. Certainly there are anti-coalition and terrorist elements seeking such capabilities.
That was Charles Delfer in his testimony just a few minutes ago before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Mike Schuster, maybe you can unpack that a little bit for us. He's talking about the possibility that even since the U.S. forces and the other nations invaded Iraq, there have been attempts to restart the weapons program.
Essentially, I think it boils down to a simple statement that the insurgents would like to have chemical weapons, and they've gone to members of the military or scientists who know about chemical weaponry to see what they can produce. This shouldn't come as a surprise, it seems to me, given the level of violence and the spread of the insurgency and the ruthlessness of the insurgents all over Iraq, that they might think, in addition to all of the explosive devices, car bombs and other tactics that they've used, that they might be able to use some residual capability that exists in Iraq, whether there might be some hidden stockpiles of chemical weapons or chemicals that they could use, or the awareness of Iraqi scientists or other military people about how to create chemical weapons. I think that's essentially what he was saying.
But it's maybe I'm just still trying to understand. Is this Mr. Delfer saying that the capability might have existed and that insurgents might have been trying to do that, but the U.S. forces have been successful in preventing this from happening?
I think he's saying that the insurgents want it, that they are looking for it. It might have existed, but that the United States, as he said, got ahead of the curve on this, which suggests that the United States might have been able to preempt those efforts so far.
We're talking with NPR correspondent Mike Schuster and former U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kaye about Charles Delfer, who is the current U.S. Weapons Inspector in Iraq, a testimony today before the Senate Armed Services Committee about his attempts to find weapons of mass destruction and the attempts to keep the capability of creating weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Well, David Kaye, do you find that scenario credible? Is it possible that the insurgents were trying to do what Mr. Delfer was suggesting?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. Look, from July 03, when I entered Iraq, we had information that the insurgents were trying to find more effective ways to deal with U.S. forces. They climbed the escalation ladder of IEDs. The initial IEDs were single artillery shells. They found out how to configure them in serial. They used initially fuses or command line to set them off. They went to cell phones. So, look, they were hunting for more and better techniques. And certainly the idea of homebrew chemical weapons is not far-fetched. It's unfortunately very easy when you're thinking of a terrorist environment to do that. So I'm not at all surprised that they were seeking that knowledge in Iraq, and certainly it's one thing that U.S. forces knew they had to be on alert for.
One of the key findings of the new report that Charles Dulfer has prepared and is testifying about that is that since the early 1970s, Iraq has consistently sought to acquire an effective long-range weapons delivery capability, and by 1991, Baghdad had purchased the missiles and infrastructure that would form the basis for nearly all of its future missile system development. The Soviet Union was a key supplier of missile hardware and provided 819 Scud-B missiles and ground support equipment. Is this new? Is this a new piece of information?
No. This is information. The early part of it was developed during UNSCOM days. The latter part of it is material that we presented, developed and presented to the Congress in October and January. They had a very large number of SA-2 missiles and of SA-2 missile engines, which actually is an engine that belongs in a science museum. It really is a thing of beauty. And they had learned how to string them together, gang them together to get longer and longer range missiles. What Charles also reports on is the activities that the Iraqis engaged in with the help of other countries, North Korea, and experts out of the former Soviet Union, to develop even longer-range missiles and more effective cruise missiles.
Okay. Mike, did you know about this, or is this news to you?
No. The whole Scud program we knew about, and those of us who covered the Gulf War in 1991 experienced it firsthand because many Scuds were launched against Saudi Arabia and Israel. What's important, I think, about Charles Dulfer's testimony today is that essentially he said what Saddam Hussein actually did make progress in reconstituting was a long-range missile capability, that he threw a lot of resources in the 1990s and on past the year 2000 in trying to reconstitute a longer-range missile program. But we learned that that was true. We learned that there were missiles that far exceeded the UN limits on the range of those missiles, and that the new UN inspectors that went in 2003, in late 2002 and 2003, discovered them and were in the process of dismantling and destroying some of them.
Okay, Mike Schuster, thank you very much. I understand you have to go and probably prepare reports for other programs, so I'll say goodbye to you now. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Joe.
Mike Schuster is NPR's correspondent. He joined us from NPR West. David Kay, I'm hoping you can stay with me here in Studio 3A. David Kay is a former weapons inspector. We're talking about the testimony by Charles Dulfer today before the Senate Armed Conservatives Committee and the news contained in his report about his investigation of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm Joe Palca. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about the testimony today by Charles Dulfer to the Senate Armed Services Committee and about his report that he's testifying about that is his work looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Charles Dulfer is the chief U.S. arms inspector. To get a sense of how the political parties are reacting to this report, we turn to two members of the House Armed Services Committee. First, Congressman Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee's 5th District. He joins us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Joe. Good afternoon.
So I know you haven't had much time to comb through the 1,500 pages, or maybe you're an extremely fast reader, but I'd like to get your initial responses. Are there any surprises to you so far?
Charles Dulfer is a very, very credible source on this. He's done extremely hard work, as has 1,700 other people looking for a WMD in Iraq. The net result is it's clearly a bad day for the administration. President Bush and Vice President Cheney went way out on a limb saying there was WMD in Iraq, and they turned out to be wrong.
Are there any questions that remain unanswered in your mind? Are there still things to find out about what kind of capabilities Saddam Hussein had after inspectors left Iraq?
Well, Dulfer points out that there's a new cache of materials that he'll be going through, but in his professional judgment, he doesn't think that there are any stockpiles. And this doesn't mean that Saddam didn't intend to have WMD. He would have liked to have had it, and he was within probably a few months of having some chemical warheads. But basically, the stockpiles and the imminent nuclear threat that was painted in the press when we went to war is just simply not true.
Do you think that this report will add any fervor to the interest in Congress passing bipartisan intelligence reform bill before the election?
I think it will, because it pinpoints the massive intelligence failure that preceded our entry into the war. You add this to Paul Bremer's statements of yesterday, saying that we needed more troops. It just seems like a mismanaged situation, not one of America's finest moments.
Okay. What effect do you think this will have on the presidential campaigns?
Well, I think on top of the debate momentum that Kerry and Edwards have, it's really helping them as we go into the final weeks of the campaign. Because Charles Dulfer is the consummate professional. Nobody knows more about Iraq and WMD than he does, and he came up empty-handed. President Bush himself said for months that, well, let's wait and see what Charlie tells us. This is the definitive word, and the definitive word is the administration was dead wrong on the WMD issue.
Congressman Jim Cooper, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Jim Cooper is a Democrat from Tennessee's 5th District and a member of the House Armed Services Committee. He joined us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C., and if you want to know what the key findings of the Charles Dulfer report are, you can go to npr.org, where you can find a link to the report. And now we turn to Republican Congressman Tom Cole, who represents Oklahoma's 4th District. He's also a member of the House Armed Services Committee, and he's with us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
Well, and same questions I just had to your colleague. I know it's early days, and 1,500 pages is a long report. Have you seen enough to form some initial opinions?
Well, I certainly have, particularly in concert with what we've seen from previous Senate intelligence reports and the 9/11 Commission. I think a clearer picture is beginning to emerge here of exactly what was happening on the eve of the war inside Iraq.
And how would you characterize that picture?
I think it's mixed. Clearly. We overestimated the immediate capabilities that Saddam Hussein had. On the other hand, as the report makes clear, it systematically violated the sanctions that he was under. He was working toward getting out from under those sanctions. He was going to have, within a matter of months, the ability to produce WMDs of various types, and he was definitely set on doing that. And given his previous record of having and using those weapons and his hostility toward the United States, I think we had every justification to take preemptive action when we did.
What effect do you think that this report will have on the Bush campaign, which has been saying that the threat Iraq, what the Bush campaign has been saying about the threat that Iraq posed to national security when we invaded?
I think it will establish the fact that the president was right, that there was an emerging threat in Iraq, that Saddam Hussein was neither a toothless tiger nor one who had lost his predatory intentions and appetite. And, it's amazing to me, the critics are basically saying the president was right too soon. He acted too soon. In other words, the threat, we should have allowed the threat to mature longer, allowed weapons to be acquired, allowed to see it almost to the eve of attack. And, of course, the dangerous thing for the president's standpoint, for the country's standpoint, is once these weapons are created, they can now be very quickly transferred to terrorist organizations that can use them in a stealthy fashion. We're not dealing with nation states here. We're dealing with between the junction of a nation state on one hand and a terrorist organizations on the other. And I think there's every reason to believe someone like Saddam Hussein would have transferred and used weapons against the country. I think the president was wise to act when he did and in the way he did.
Congressman, I'd like to turn to one of our callers, if it's all right with you. Joe in Orem, Utah, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great.
My question basically is, it seems kind of obvious to me that there's, political motivation behind the timing of the release of this report. And I'm wondering if, we're only 1 month away from the election, and I'm wondering if anyone can make a comment on whether we knew ahead of time that this report was coming, or whether the weapons inspector just kind of sprung it on us, randomly. I'm wondering if there's anything that can be said about that.
Okay, Joe, good question. Maybe the congressman has some insights for
us. Yeah, this report has been quite some time in the making. I agree with Congressman Cooper's remarks. Mr. Dulfer is a well-respected expert. I think it's a thorough piece of work. I think it's emerging now simply because this is the point at which they felt most comfortable beginning to publicly put out some of the results. And frankly, I would prefer to see it before the election. I think a report immediately after an election would probably raise some concerns that people were trying to withhold information from the public. I don't think that's what's going on here at all. I think we're working in a good faith effort, frankly, on both sides of the aisle. It obviously has some political impact, but the reality is we want to put as much information in front of the American people as we possibly can before they make decisions in November.
Okay, Congressman Cole, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Congressman Tom Cole represents Oklahoma's 4th District and is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. He was with us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. The Armed Services Committee hearing with Charles Dulfer continues. The hearing has entered the question and answer phase, and the first question from Committee Chairman Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia goes straight to the heart of the politics surrounding this hearing.
Is it your professional judgment that the world is better off with Saddam Hussein now in custody, facing the rule of law?
Well, in my opinion, there was a risk of Saddam Hussein being in charge of a country with that amount of resources and with that amount of potential for both good and evil. What Iraq was under Saddam and the potential of what it could be, there was an enormous difference. The trends, I think, are important. And our analysis in this study was to not look at a single point in time, but to look at dynamics and trends. He clearly had ambitions with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He clearly had a strategy and tactic to get out of the constraints of the UN sanctions. He was clearly making a great deal of progress on that. But for the intervention of the events of 9/11, I think the world would be in a very different position right now.
In conclusion, the world is better off with his now facing in custody the rule of law to account for his crimes.
I'm an analyst, and I realize I'm in a political world right now.
No, it's a
but I have to agree, analytically, the world is better off.
David Kay, former weapons inspector, joins me here in Studio 3A, and I wonder, how would you respond to Senator Warner's question?
Well, Charlie and I have both spent a considerable amount of our last decade and a half of our lives in and around Iraq, and I don't think anyone who has done that up close as we have has any sympathy for Saddam Hussein and a great deal of sympathy for the damage he did to Iraq society. So my gut reaction is, yes, I'm glad he's in custody and out of power. I thought Charlie's answer was a very measured one. The thing that worried me the most was that, in fact, Iraq was a more dangerous place than we realized. That is, it was in a vortex of corruption. It had both money and a lot of technical knowledge about WMD. And my experience of how markets work is if there is a willing buyer and a willing seller, and terrorist organizations have been seeking more powerful weapons, that in fact that would slip out. And certainly my belief is our intelligence system is not good enough to identify that sort of leakage. It took almost 20 years to catch AQ Khan, who was leaking to North Korea, Iran, and Libya at least. So, yeah, I'm glad he's gone.
We're talking with former U.S. Chief Weapons Inspector David Kay. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wonder, David Kay, can I ask you, there are UN inspectors right now on the ground in Iran. What is this report and this experience that the U.S. has had in Iraq going to do to that that effort?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that the UN inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency have learned a lot since 1991. The UN inspections pre-1991, and at that point I was an employee of their National Atomic Energy Agency, quite frankly were not very good when faced with a clandestine effort to procure weapons. The best example of how far we still have to go is that Iran continued its program for 18 years undetected. And the irony is the initial detection came about because of an Iranian dissident group, one that's actually formally labeled as a terrorist organization by the U.S. until very recently. So, you know, inspections have gotten better. It's a tough job when you're against a hostile regime that doesn't want you to find out anything. But they are clearly better than they were a decade ago. They've made a lot of progress. And I think one lesson is you need to make inspections more capable, more powerful, and support them with more international consolidated effort if you ever hope to contain these regimes and want to avoid the horrible choice that the president faced after 9/11 when confronting the intelligence evidence that said Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Did you ever feel political pressure when you're kind of carrying out your job?
No, not at all. I must say, the president told me when I went in that my job was to find out the truth about the Iraq WMD program. I never had from the administration any pressure at all, either with regard to the timing of the report or the content. And in fact, they didn't even review the report prior to my delivering it.
Let me ask you this. You were talking about the effort and the technology of detecting weapons, and we were talking about the difficulty of proving the negative. Is there going to come a day, do you think, in any kind of an inspection program where a weapons inspection program is so clear-cut that anybody who chose to make an argument based on it differing from its findings would simply have no leg to stand on?
I regret I don't see that in the future. In fact, I think the trend lines, particularly in the biological area, are going against us. Biological research has become so pervasive in the modern world. The tools are so good and getting better every day, computerized tools as opposed to actually having to do laboratory experiments, basic biological processing's at the heart of a modern economy, that in fact the inspector's job has become much harder, and it's become the forensic tools we use as inspectors. While in one sense they're more powerful than they ever were, the problem they're dealing with is more extensive than it ever was, and the knowledge you realize in the biological area, in essence of biological production, is you need to contain that process. So containment and concealment is the essence, whether it's a commercial product, drugs, a vaccine manufacturer, or whether it's in fact anthrax or some more powerful biological agent. It's a race, and unfortunately I think the inspectors have a tougher race than the people who are out producing it.
Well, I was just going to say, so is there a particular place that you would put research and development effort for the intelligence community at this point? Is it better detectors for biological agents or chemical agents or nuclear agents?
Certainly, absolutely. You need better, more dependable, robust detectors for biological agents, but what you need are two types. You need stuff that can stand off and do things at a distance. Remember, regimes like Iran, North Korea, are not ones that you can freely walk around with, so you'd like to do it further and further out. The other thing you need is discrimination against false positives. The thing that bedevils inspections is you'll have your detection gear go off and signal, A, you've got a hit, you've got anthrax, VX, whatever the agent is. And it turns out on more careful laboratory analysis not to be that at all, but an environmental contaminant. False positives kill inspections and erode the confidence of one's political masters about how good a job inspectors are doing.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this discussion. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Happy to do it.
David Kaye is a former chief U.S. weapons inspector, and he's been talking to us today about the report that was just released by Charles Dulfer and testimony that Dulfer is making before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. And if you want to see the key recommendations of that report, surf on over to npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Thank you.